Shall we pray together? Our Heavenly Father, you know who is in this room. And you know where each one has come from. You know where each one has come from physically, from various parts of New England and some from other parts of the world. And you know where each one has come from intellectually, what has been the teaching through the years of each one's background. You know the false ideas that have been given from one place and another. And you know the truth that has been heard and understood and acted upon. You know the friends of each one sitting here. Each one who is here, I'm sure, has members of their family, whether close family members, mother, father, child, brother, sister, or cousins, aunts, uncles. You know people who have members in their families who are unbelievers, who are skeptics, who are searching, and who have need of understanding. You know how easy it is to be off-putting of people who come with questions which sometimes seem insincere, with remarks which are needling, trying to make fun of what we believe. You know how hard it is to respond properly and to live a life which commends what we believe to other people without being insufferably pious or a pain in the neck to people by trying to show off or trying to be better than they are in some way that just annoys. You know what balance we need that we find hard to have in ourselves. And I would ask now, as I begin to talk this time, for your strength and for your words and for your direction in giving that which would be the greatest help to each individual who is here in his or her individual need. You know, it would be humanly impossible, even if I could know each person's background and present situation and the situation of all the relatives and all the friends. You know, it would be impossible to say that which would meet the need of each one because of my finiteness and my inadequacy and weakness. But you are able to take the pen of the words and the subject matter and to bring to my mind things that would be answering something in someone else's area of need. Not only that, you could bring something that would answer a question that is coming tomorrow or the day after tomorrow to someone who is sitting here. So I pray that we may have not just an interesting time together, a thought-provoking time, but I pray that it may be a time that may be very much your time for each one of us, for myself too. And I ask for your strength in my weakness, particularly at this time of the day, this time of physical tiredness. And I ask for this not for any lesser reason than for your glory and for the proclamation of truth. In Jesus' name, amen. It is very true that for, I'm sure for every one of you, I've lived long enough and known enough people to know that I don't know that I've ever met anyone, including myself, that doesn't have some friend, some relative, someone who is a skeptic, an agnostic, an atheist, who really resists the truth, resists talking about the truth or hearing it, walks out of the room perhaps. And whether there are questions in your own mind and that you have struggled with yourself and sort of brushed under the rug, or whether there are questions that keep coming to you from other people, or suddenly spring up from a small child, because children have brains, you know, and come forth with some of the most basic philosophic questions at the most amazingly young ages. So what we're going to try to talk about is not that which is off there and belongs to some hyper-intellectual group that wants to discuss and doesn't touch us, because we're all practical and we're just going to live on the basis of our faith. We need to recognize that there are questions there and there are seeking people there. As we come to the Old Testament, there's a great solo lifted out of the Old Testament that is one of my favorite solos, and that is the tenor solo, "If with all thine heart you truly seek me, ye shall surely, surely find me." I see some of you nodding, and I'm sure you hear the music as well as the words in your ears. "If with all thine heart you truly seek me, ye shall surely, surely find me." What does it mean, "with all thine heart"? And the other from the New Testament, "He that willeth to do the will of God shall know of the doctrine," the teaching, the understanding. He that willeth to do the will. These two things come together in the area of honesty and sincerity of search. Now, you cannot take your cousin or your aunt or your uncle or your brother or your sister or your mother or your father or your children or whoever your friends are and evaluate or weigh, measure, make a judgment as to how honest and sincere the search is. Sometimes the honesty and sincerity can be very hidden from another person, from another human being. And sometimes someone who seems to be very honest may have a very dishonest motive in their search. So only God knows who really, really is sincere and honest in searching for truth. But God has promised that if human beings seek with honesty and sincerity, with all their hearts, with all their beings, with all their motives, they're really seeking Him, they will find Him. People come to you and will continue to come to you and say, throughout your lifetime and mine, look at all the Hindu people in India and all of those in another country and so on, Mohammedans or whatever. Millions, thousands have not come to God, have turned away. How come? And banging right into the midst of where the hardest questions come to start with, and we'll go on with some others. And among other things, you need to tie into what I've just been saying the last hour about the compassion of God. And remember that if you're worried about all these people, if you have compassion that bothers you sufficiently to keep you awake, to cause you to pray for them or to do something, then we may know very, very readily that God cares far more. And that when he says, with all thine heart, and combining that with he walks up and down the earth to see whose heart is inclined toward him, there's that inclination. I'm talking about the unbeliever, I mean the one who doesn't know now, but who is seeking. The inclination that is real, that is a desire to know the living God with the motive, the intention of bowing, of being his person, his a part of his people, that motive is one which God promises will bring the person to really find him. There are many other motives that are camouflage of sincerity. Very, very often among people who know, say, the people of India well, missionaries who've worked in India a long time, will tell me and tell you that the washing in the Ganges or the doing of what has to be done to appease the gods is done in order to bring about a result such as good crops, something advantageous materially or physically to the person. Not because of a search for truth or a search for God, if there be a God. Oh God, make me sincere in my search in looking for you is the prayer that someone ought to have on their lips. Not even trusting their own sincerity, but if there be a God, I want to bow before him. I want to know him. I want to know the truth of this universe. I want to know really who I am. Am I a creature created by a creator, or am I just a chance collection of particles? Is this all I am? Is this all I am? I really want to find out. And if I come to the place of finding out, then I want to give myself to God. How much does a person have to know? And before we talk about the fact that there are answers to the questions of skeptics and so on, I would say that, thank God, a person does not need to know very much. The honesty and sincerity counts the most. I've just left a person at Libby I talked to very late Sunday night when I had expected to do some packing so I wouldn't be staying up too late the night before we left. I stayed up too late the night before we left because of this conversation and other things which interrupted. This person told me a most amazing story of coming to a point of planning to walk out of the world in suicide. And without background, I'm not going into the whole story, but without background, without having any evangelical teaching, you can't say, oh, well, that was just an emotional, charismatic happening that happened to this person because she didn't know anything. I mean, nobody had taught her anything. But on the point of getting out of a very, very difficult situation of a husband that was on drugs and an alcoholic, and doors were being beaten down, and things were in an impossible situation, and she felt she could not go on another minute, she lifted up a Bible that she had not opened for 11 years, and then only as a Roman Catholic who had, in a very, without practicing, without a believing at all in anything at that time, just used it in some mass or service or something, but just picked up the book without knowing and said, God, before I do this thing, if you exist and if this really is truth, then you tell me something that shows me that so, and I will base my life on this book. Now that could have been from the outside, if you'd heard the words in your ears and if you had seen even an earnest look on the face or a distressed look, you couldn't have known whether there was a reality or not. The only way that I know now is because I know what took place the following subsequent months and couple of years. She opened the Bible at random. I am not saying that I think this is a good thing to do, any more than I say I think that it was a good thing to do for my husband to flip coins to find the Lord's will, which you will find in the tapestry as I tell the agonizing search of his desire to do the Lord's will, go to college to prepare for the ministry, if that was what God wanted, which necessitated his disobeying his father, his crossing his father totally, and saying, I'm obeying God instead of you. All right, he wouldn't tell anyone else to do what he did that night. No one had ever talked to him about anything. He had never had any evangelical teaching either, only the Bible itself. Read the book and you'll find out where Francis Schaeffer came from. This woman asked God for a word from him that would help her to know he existed. She opened the book and her eyes fell on the words, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. And she was to find out much later all that meant. But at that moment, she took it. And she said, all right, I base my life on this book and on truth, and you show me what it is, God. And gradually, I don't know how the story's going to end. She's there at LaBrie now with her two children. Gradually, she found sufficient knowledge and has grown and has come there. Take you to China. Well, no, the hills beyond China in Lisu land many, many years ago, before the Lisu work got really underway. And, of course, now the communists have come in and swept that hill country, and so many have been killed and they've been dispersed. The Lisu tribe were just beginning to get the gospel, and Honey too lived in a village that had never been reached, but the catechism had been translated and put into writing and so on. One day as he was walking along in the woods, he found this bit of paper that said, are there more gods than one? No, there's only one God. Should you worship the idols? No, you should not worship the idols. You should worship the one living God. Finished, done. It's all he knew. And with that much, he tore down the paper idols in his house. He believed that this God existed. He was sure that these idols were wrong, and he bore the consequences of tearing down the idols. Neighbors all against him, something awful is going to happen to you, this is terrible, you know, you're going to be attacked. Sure enough, his little girl became very, very ill. And not knowing where this God was or how to reach him, he climbed the highest mountain in that area, 10,000 feet high, and shouted when he got to the top, oh God, if you can hear me, make my little girl well so they'll know that I did the right thing. God is compassionate. He wrings the heart. If with all thine heart you truly seek me, ye shall surely, surely know me. Honey-Too came back and found that little girl was sitting up. The fever had left her, and she was well. A heathen village, not a Christian for miles around. Much, much later, Honey-Too found in a Chinese marketplace down at the bottom of the mountains a copy of the Gospel of Mark. He became an understanding believer. He knew about Christ who had died for him then. But the reality of bowing and of searching, the truth of the sincerity in searching for the truth was there. The bowing came earlier than the amount of knowledge that he needed. Now, he later became a missionary to the other Lisu, and many, many heard through his lips God had raised up a man in a period of history before the communists came, a good many years before the communists came to sweep that country. And thousands of Lisu were saved through Frazier's work, yes, the missionary Frazier and Isabel Kuhn and the Cooks, those of you who might know anything about that work. But this Lisu man turned and believed. All right, it isn't that then you can turn your back and say, all right, those other people don't matter. Yes, we are responsible for making truth known. And the skeptics who are around you, you may say, well, they've had plenty of opportunity. The Bible's printed in the English language. There are thousands and millions of copies around. They can buy them at any old bookstore. They are without excuse. Yes, the book of Romans says that that people are without excuse. People are without excuse because we come there for just a moment. And we're not going to study the whole book of Romans in this. You therefore have no excuse, you who pass judgment on someone else, the second chapter, for what at whatever point you judge the other, you're condemning yourself, because you who pass judgment do the same thing. Now we know that God's judgment against those who do such things is based on truth. It follows the chapter which the first chapter which gives you a description of those who have changed the truth of God for a lie or doing all of these things which we see all around us every day. The sinful desires of their hearts, sexual impurity, degrading their bodies with one another, serving the creature rather than the creator, the created things rather than creator. God gave them over to their shameful lust. Depraved minds, full of envy, murder, strife, malice. They invent ways of doing evil, and so on. Our day is described. But Romans goes on to say that people are really without excuse because of God's creation and also because of his communication that he has given down through centuries. So there are two things. There is the fact that there's so much that God has revealed and put into the world that people are supposed to recognize and begin searching for him. And then there is the wonder of an honest seeking heart finding him even in the most incredibly impossible places. Now the Bible makes clear that we do have minds that are to be thinking, understanding. We are to understand. And we could go through many, many different passages. In my first couple of chapters of Common Sense Christian Living, I've gone into this area of the fact that we're supposed to have sense, wisdom as opposed to foolishness. And we're to ask for wisdom where we don't have wisdom and so on. And the verse I read this morning from Hebrews that we're to understand that the things that we see are made out of things that are not seen. We're not introduced to a religion that we just have to accept without any thinking, that there's something bad, there's something wrong with thinking or asking questions. And too often little children are told, now you don't ask any questions, you just believe that. How do I know that this isn't a dream? Well, it isn't, dear, and that's all there is to it, and you know, I'm not going to bother with that. I mean, that's a good question. That's a philosophic question. How do I know that all of life is not a dream? How do I know, you know, what's the difference between reality and fantasy? Where does the difference lie? and so on. There are questions that need to be dealt with, and we can hold up our heads because truth is true. And as my husband often says, the truth of all that we see and know about, the truth that exists necessitates God. The explanation of those who are skeptics do not satisfy the questions, not even, they don't even satisfy themselves. No one can live on the basis of their own working out of what the universe is and who they are, apart from the existence of God. No one can live on the basis that they have spun out, which is untrue. It's not the real base. And they can't live on it. And that is a good thing to point out sometimes to your skeptic friends, or to remember yourself in the moment of your own questions. Is it possible to live on the basis of chance, or of everything being predetermined by chemical determinism, or by psychological determinism? Do people not make choices? Do they stand at a street and say, I'm not going to wait for the light to go green because I'm just predetermined like this, and the reason I feel like crossing in the middle of traffic is because that's the way my genes are, it's the way my chemical makeup is, it's impossible for me to make a choice. Where then does an explanation come? Just in this area of choice, if after all everything is just a collection of particles. I heard the Harvard professor Walls in Mexico, when he was speaking there at the Young Presidents Organization in 1972, I think it was, 11 years ago. And it was fascinating to sit there where you're sitting and listen to him spinning out that which my husband has said in his books, that that these men do, taking this leap. I had never sat in Harvard, you see, under his teaching, so I had this opportunity in 1 hour. In 1 hour, he was going from the beginning up to the present day. Now, here is the explanation of all things given in the words of this particular skeptic, who said he had no place for God in his scheme of things. Eons and eons of years ago, he began, there were nothing but particles swimming about in chaotic disorder, and suddenly by chance two came together and they formed, and then he gave the formula. And then on through history, now this is only 1 hour, by chance and the carbon molecules and this and the other, and finally up to, we were up to living amoeba and so on, and up into the atomic bomb problem. The atomic bomb problem and the ecological imbalances of not enough algae in the sea and what's going to happen to our oxygen and so forth. And as I sat there, I thought, but what difference does it make, my dear man, if all these chance beings that came about, some chance coming together of formulas through the ages, if by chance they make destructive things like bombs and do away with themselves, what difference does it make? Really, what difference does it make? Really, I mean, there's no logic. Now, as he went on, and he was talking to presidents, you see, of companies who could be pouring out waste into the streams, etc. So he was wanting some response of action. So he gets up to the end of the collection of atomic bombs that we've got to get rid of, and the algae must be properly cared for, etc. And then he did not take a book and open it. He quoted something. He said, "There's a book that I read. I have no place for God in my scheme of things. But I read a book that I enjoy reading, and I want to quote something from it." So what he said that day was this: to finish this great, and he was eloquent. Don't misunderstand me. He was eloquent. It was brilliant. It was very interesting and fascinating. And he came to the end, but he had to have an emotional impact, you see, to make people feel they had to do something about all this. And he said, "I will quote this: therefore choose life, that you and your descendants may live." Finished. Wasn't that great? Everybody jumped up and clapped and said, "Wasn't that marvelous? Isn't that wonderful?" You know, therefore choose life. Yeah, there's our sound effects. Choose life, that you and your descendants may live. Well, I went back to my room in the hotel, and I got my Bible, and I looked up this verse, which I recognized from the 30th chapter of Deuteronomy. But you see, he'd taken it totally out of context. You were to choose to get rid of the atomic bomb. You were to choose to do something about ecological imbalances. I'm not saying that's a bad thing to do, but that's all there was to it. So that the cycle could go on, the cycle, the endless cycle. And where is it going? And is history going anyplace? And what's it all about? And if there's no truth, and there's nobody home in the universe, and it's an impersonal universe, now get that firmly fixed. And of course, if you've read my husband's books, this is my husband's speech, me giving it, only of course it's not his speech, but anyway, it's sort of. he would say, you know, there are only two possible beginnings, a personal beginning or an impersonal beginning. Wald had spun out the impersonal beginning. The personal beginning is the Creator, the Triune God, communication already there, love already there, thinking, acting, feeling, having ideas, creativity, all these things already there. Never did they have a beginning. I mean, these things that men search for some answer to. Where did compassion come from? Where did love come from? Biological urges, sex, but no love. Where on earth did love come from? How could these impersonal particles come about to have love? All right, there are two possible beginnings, personal or impersonal, and he had given the impersonal one, but he ended it with a personal ending, mind you. He couldn't live with his own presuppositions. And even in the one-hour speech, he couldn't end it on an impersonal note. He had to grab something that didn't belong to him. He said he didn't believe in God, but he had to grab something out of God's word and use it to give a wallop. Choose life. How can you choose anything? What does choose mean if we're just a chance collection of particles that are chemically predetermined? How can you choose anything? What's life anyhow? What do you mean what's life? It's all death. What's reality? What is reality? Is being zonked out on liquor and drugs and lying under the bridges in Paris or on the streets of San Francisco or in Boston, is that reality? And are the rest of us prancing around here with some talk about purpose and and reason for living? Are we living in a fantasy? What is reality? And you take this man's quote, he quoted it, I didn't, and put it into context, and you see that he has no excuse. He knows the passage, or he couldn't have quoted it. Here's what Moses is saying. Now I am commanding you today, what I am commanding you today is not too difficult for you or beyond your reach. It is not up in in heaven so that you have to ask who will ascend into heaven to get it and proclaim it to us so that we may obey it. Nor is it beyond the sea so that you have to ask who will cross the sea to get it and proclaim it to us so that we may obey it. No, the word is very near you. It is in your mouth and in your heart so you may obey. This is Deuteronomy 30, 11, down to the end. See, I set before you today life and prosperity, death and destruction. For I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to keep his commands, decrees, and laws. Then you will live and increase. And the Lord your God will bless you in the land you're entering to possess. But if your heart turns away and you're not obedient and you're drawn away to bow down to other gods and worship them, I declare to you this day, you will certainly be destroyed. This day I call to heaven and earth as witnesses against you that I have set before you life and death, blessings and curses. Then comes his quote, now choose life so that you and your children may live. Is that talking about getting rid of weapons and getting rid of an imbalance in the atmosphere? This is very, very clear. God is saying, you choose to bow down and worship God, or you choose to walk away from him. Choose life so that you and your children may live. And then he goes on to make it even more clear. That you may love the Lord your God, listen to his voice, and hold fast to him. For the Lord is your life, and he will give you many years in the land he swore to give you to your fathers, Abraham and Jacob. The Lord is your life. There is such a thing as life, and you're to choose life. What I'm trying to point out right now is, now I'm not going to teach the book of Deuteronomy, but just to say that people cannot live with their own presuppositions as they wipe God totally out. The illustration I'd like to bring at this moment is the new book of Crick, who discovered the DNA template. And as a scientist, men look to in the area of understanding where life came from without God. Crick has written a new book, which was reviewed in the London Observer, and almost at the same time was reviewed in Newsweek. And in that book, he states that he is not satisfied with what scientists, including himself, have set forth as the origin of life on this planet, as to where the living molecules came from that then went on to bring forth the whole evolutionary process. I know your high school teachers or your grade school teachers or the writers of the Golden Books can teach the children and everybody else in such a fashion as to make people think, boy, you know, the skeptics and the atheists have got all the facts, and those people that believe in God, they're just a bunch of numbskulls that have faith. We've got facts over here. And the teachers of the younger children very often bring this out so strongly that the children think that, you know, to believe the Bible to be true and that there's a creator, you've really got to just take your intellect and hang it on a hook. And And the people who are real thinkers, they've got all these facts. My husband was debating in Cambridge. I'm going on with Crick in a minute. But my husband was debating in Cambridge some years ago in front of, atheist society, the humanist society. And he was debating the president of the humanist society, and all the humanist society people were the audience. And Fran said, well, I make one rule. I'll come and do the debate if there are no Christians present, because I'm just afraid that the Christians might clap or make a noise or say yay, yay, or something at the wrong time, and I don't want any interference. I'd just like this to be a straight debate. Okay, so they said, fine, there wouldn't be any Christians there, only the humanists, the humanist society. So walking across the quad there, the grass of beautiful Cambridge, he said to the young man that night, the man said to him, excuse me, now who's going to begin? Supposedly the man that begins is at a disadvantage. If any of you are debaters, you're better off if you get to be the next one, the second, get your word in next. Fran said, I don't care, whichever way you want it, you know. All right, says the other fellow, you begin then. Fran said, fine, I'll begin. So as he got up to start, Fran said, well, there is a mistaken statement that most humanists make that I would like to speak against right now. They say that they have facts and the Christian has faith. But I would like to say that it's faith against faith, and I could not possibly have the faith that you humanists have to believe what you believe as to the origins of all things, you know. And he really meant it. Well, that fella took the next hour trying to get himself out of that box. And at the end, when the whole thing was through, there was such a hissing and a booing. And Fran said to the, he said, I thought I told you not to have any Christians here. You know, that really wasn't fair. And the guy said, there aren't any Christians here. Those are all the humanists that are born. Because he never did get himself out of that box. All right, now we're ready to talk about Crick in his book. In that he set forth, now to be fair, the book does not say, I think this is the way it is. The book says this is a probability, a possibility, all this kind of language. Crick says, I am not satisfied with the scientist's theory concerning the origin of life. And then he goes on to spin a possibility. And you won't believe it, but this is it. Probably or possibly, billions of years ago. Now, if you put enough years, notice always this. You have to have lots of years, and then you can believe anything. A lot of years. And distance, far away, billions of years ago, on another planet, there was conscious life. Now, where did it come from? We don't go into that. Conscious life. Conscious life that was so altruistic as to plan how to not have life be extinct in the universe. And so these creatures planned to freeze molecules in spaceships. And they sent a spaceship with frozen molecules, which took 10,000 years to get to our planet Earth, and then defrosted. And the first molecules then, did the whole thing, and evolution started in the whole world. That is a possibility. When you think of the far out search I would say this. Skeptics are sorrowful, broken, suicidal, searching for meaning and purpose, having questions without answers, longing to find out how did life begin and what is life anyway and what is reality. Is there any future? Is history ever going anywhere? Why is there anything instead of nothing? And what is the mystery of being? You can't know among your friends and your family and your relatives and the person that is dimming away at you and saying you're absolutely crackers, you know, this is ridiculous, nobody with a brain would believe this and so on. You can't know how dark the darkness is where there's nobody home in the universe, how lonely it is with nobody to call out to. My husband got very angry at seeing Sagan's, well, we didn't see much of it, just one episode of that Cosmos. And he got very angry at the things that were being said and the statements and so on. My reaction was different. He'll tell you this. I'm not telling tales out of school, but my reaction was different. I became very sad at looking at that man's face because it seemed to me that he had such an intense longing or search pictured in his eyes. Now, I may be reading him all wrong. I mean, maybe he isn't like that at all, but it seemed to me that this awe with which he looked out at the cosmos was an awe that had no personal person to respond to it. An empty awe, if I could put it that way. An empty awe. An empty worship. No object of his worship. No person there at home in the universe. An impersonal universe that came about by chance and is so magnificent. And then he listens for something from another planet. Why is it E.T. became so popular so rapidly? Because people so want something from somewhere to give hope that this isn't all there is, that somebody else is at home in the universe. There's somebody else out there. Why? Why do people among the skeptics and among the very lost ones and among the superior ones who think that we're being weak, wanting a crutch, needing aspirins to get through life and therefore grabbing for some kind of religion. Why is it that there is such a, if I could put it, wistfulness as well as seen in Sagan's face, a kind of a worship of just the works rather than the artist who made the works. The films of the early films, at any rate, of Woody Allen, the early films of Woody Allen, search for relationships, an emptiness, a sorrow, something to make us cry when people are longing for fulfillment and finding no way to be fulfilled. Why? Why is all this? Well, now, there's one factor in all this that seems to me to help point to us that truth is true. It's because human beings, you see, are who they are. They are made in the image of God. They think, they act, they feel, they have longings for communication, they have longings for continuity and love. And they keep banging their heads against the walls that are there, but they deny are there. My husband used to give two illustrations years ago, and since this is his speech, I'll give them to you. He would say, supposing We would turn out all the lights in this room and it would be totally black, and we'd send you all out. And then we'd rearrange the furniture, the chairs, the microphones, the whatever, the piano. We'd put them all in very different forms and places. And we'd send you in one by one to run through the room on the basis of your imagination as to what it's like. And then you'd run like mad, and of course you'd end up with a varying amount depending on what direction you happen to take in your imagination. But you'd all end up, and I'd end up, with a varying amount of bumps and bruises and broken bones and so forth. Why? Because our imaginations would not change the furniture from the way it had been placed. This really is what those who deny that it is a personal universe are finding themselves in. They try to live. They try to have freedom, and the freedom gives them the bumps and bruises that are so ghastly that they commit suicide in larger numbers. Broken homes, homosexuality, lesbianism, families being broken and broken and broken, education that is changing beyond all imagination, one kind of thing after another breaking down. And people, it isn't that they're enjoying their freedom, they're breaking down with their freedom because they're bumping their shins. These are not who they really are. They're made for continuity, they're made for family relationships. They're made for generations of a child knowing a grandparent as well as a great uncle and a great aunt, knowing the generations. People are made to have a God who really is their creator, to come to as their father. It's not enough just the cross relationships either. They have a vertical possibility. And they can't live with it. They're bumping their shins. They're breaking their legs. Come to another illustration. It's still the same room. It's still my husband's illustration. It's another one. An easy one to understand, but a basic philosophic one. Supposing this room were the whole universe, and it would be filled with solids and liquids, but no free gases, no oxygen, no free gases at all. So you would have fish swimming in this universe around the rocks and the whatever. The fish would be fulfilled because there would be a universe that would be fulfilling to them. Billions of years of this, and suddenly one of the fish develops lungs. Would it be higher or lower? Would it be higher or lower? All right, it would be lower. It would drown because there would be no free gas to breathe. So the fish would drown. Now, what Fran was illustrating with this illustration is something that you need to continue to remember, not just to use in an argument, but to remember for your own self and for understanding of other people who have no God and who believe that it's an impersonal universe. If Wald and all of the men who are teaching biology in this way are right, we are all just a chance collection of particles, really. And there is no personality in the universe. It doesn't exist. We have developed personality by chance, as that fish developed lungs. You've developed aspirations, longings, artistic urges and desires. You've developed longings for communication and for love. And you have some longings also for worship. forgetting all the Christians now, you've got all these other people. They're into everything. Into is the word. Into TM, into yogi, into all kinds of things. Trying to make physically an attitude of worship and trying to become peaceful. Certain, I mean, you all know the formulas for having relaxed shoulders and doing all kinds of things that make you peaceful. All right. There is nobody home in the universe in this scheme of things. And there's nothing that is possible for people to do but drown. It's an illusion. It's lower. It's lower than the animals. It's lower than the animals because there's nobody home in the universe to fulfill this which has come by accident. Do you see it? People do not live on the basis of all this other teaching, which would give you this which I've just said. This is not what we believe, quickly, if anybody stopped listening a few sentences back and thinks I'm teaching something. People can't live on the basis of this because they are who they are. They are human beings with significance in a significant history. They are human beings made in the image of God. And you say, oh, but how can it be? How can it be that those who deny God can make great works of art or do great works of science and so on? It's because they cheat, so to speak. God has made human beings in his image, and there's a lot of leftover beauty in God's creation. You look at the sea, at the mountains, at the stars, at certain pieces of scenery that have not been spoiled by avalanches or earthquakes or fire, that have a beauty that to your eyes and to my eyes seems totally unspoiled. And you say, oh, thank God for this leftover beauty of your creation. I know it's all been spoiled, but this is so marvelous that I feel I'm getting a glimpse of what it might have been before it was spoiled. Human beings are like this. Without sin, no, I'm not talking about that. All of us have sinned, and every human being has sinned. But some are more physically beautiful, and some are more physically perfect in their athletic abilities, so that you watch the gymnasts or the skaters of the Olympics, and you think, wow, look at those human beings. How do they get that way? Some are more amazing in their artistic achievements, and some like Leonardo da Vinci have such a tremendous mixture of talents that you think, how could that all be in one human being? I would say leftover beauty from God's creation. Without sin, no, I don't mean that at all. I just mean that we're diverse, we're not carbon copies of each other. You are not a carbon copy of anybody else, nor is anybody else of you. Nor are the lost carbon copies of each other. So you see the diversity of human beings. It's, again, a proof to us of human beings made to think, to act, to feel, to be creative, to have ideas, to make choices, to do creative things, to make discoveries, to go on in life, even if they don't know why it is or how it is that they are made this way. They are cheating because they go on without living on the basis of that there's no purpose and there's no meaning. It's a struggle. It's a struggle. I don't know where I am in my time. I don't want to keep you beyond when you're supposed to. Pardon? 5 more minutes. I think this is supposed to be a time when you can ask questions, and I suddenly have a great guilt feeling that I didn't let anybody ask anything. Does anybody have a question? The question is, will I deal with
the question of theistic evolution in a couple of minutes. I would say that the first thing to be said is that you cannot, as a Christian, have Adam and Eve, are you listening? Not be directly created by God. Now, if by theistic evolution you mean that you think that there have been some changes that have taken place under God's way of, well, I mean, we don't know anything yet. We're waiting until we get to heaven to find out how it all did take place. So yes, if you have some thought of something that would fit in with what Scripture has put as the boundary line, matter was created. God existed forever. What scientists are teaching today is that matter particles existed forever. It used to be when we were younger that people went beyond that. Now the teaching really is, I mean, if my husband were here and there was a blackboard, he would say, you know, that you cannot start with nothing. Nobody starts anymore with nothing. They teach a forever eternal existent matter, and then somehow it all came together. And again, you probably know, this is my husband's speech, so I'm using some of his old illustrations. You know his illustration, or maybe you don't know it, of the experiment that was made at MIT, in which chaos was put into a computer, and then, you know, many, many years, I don't know how many millions of years, were simulated in the computer to see what would come out the other end. And what came out the other end was chaos. There was not, I mean, we really do not know by any human experimentation of order coming out of chaos. Nor do we know of anything more fantastic than the order in this universe. Such an orderly universe that the scientists can compute what's going to happen out there in space when they send their spaceship out and get it back on that pad in California or wherever. Zoom, right on the spot and at the moment. How come? Well, they are bright. I'm not saying they aren't bright. But there's an order there. They didn't make the order. The order is already there. Created in the image of God, we're told very clearly that Adam and Eve were separate from the rest of creation. They were made in the image of God. One man, one woman. There is no embarrassment in accepting this gorgeous answer to the wonder of human beings. Not that they groped upward, but that they were made perfect, and then came the fall. And then came the downfall. Death began. You know, they say, you know, if you're born, you begin to die the minute you're born. Your cells, you know, deteriorate. By the time you get to my age, well then, you know, you're nearly there. You're deteriorating. All right. Adam and Eve did not begin to die the minute they were created. That's not what we're told. Death was not in the world. Not in the cells, not in, you know, there was no beginning to go down. It was after they chose, and it was a choice, to believe Satan and to act upon what Satan had said, rather than to believe God and act upon what he had said. But the death of the relationship came between God and human and the two of them, and the death of their perfect relationship with each other and their balance as human beings. Everybody's been a bit schizophrenic since then. We all are a bit unbalanced. None of us is perfect. We don't know what perfect is. We've never seen a perfect person or a perfect relationship or a perfect child or a perfect anything. We're waiting. We will see one day, and it'll be all of us. We'll be perfect. There won't be some other being from another planet. It'll be us. Change to be like Christ. But Adam and Eve, made in the image of God, and then fallen. And then Christ is called the second man, Adam, who came to be in our image, in the sense of that he took our sins upon him. He didn't become, he did not sin, but he became sin for us. But it's all, it's not a problem. It isn't that we've got to believe in theistic evolution so that we can keep up with Crick. Crick has a problem keeping up with himself. He doesn't know how to explain life. Don't be fooled. It's faith. It's faith that they have. They have tremendous faith to be able to accept their own explanations of things. There's no explanation for human personality, no explanation for aspiration, for creativity. Why do human beings make great artworks? Why did they always? Why do you find artworks in the tombs? Where did this creativity come from? The need of giving an explanation for all this is on the other side. It's on the other side. It isn't that that your answers are not sufficient for believing what God has unfolded as the explanation of history. It's the rebellion against bowing before the living God. It isn't that Cain didn't know as much as Abel. I'm sure of that. When you get to Hebrews, you see that there was a rebellious heart on the part of Cain. We had a very, very brilliant Chinese at La Brie many years ago. Young, brilliant. He's a professor. I won't say his name right at this moment. Though I have before. I don't know why I don't now. But I'm very fond of him, and I'm still praying for him. He one night said to my husband in the living room there at Malaise, I believe that this is the most logical explanation of all things, but I would rather be locked without bowing my head and live in a universe of chaos than to bow before a creator. It's the rebellion against bowing. Jesus, the Son of God, walked and talked with men and women. Some believed and some turned their back, not only spitting upon him and killing him, but just simply walking away. Every period of history has been that way. And according to the Word of God, it will be to the very end. And in a future time when Christ reigns on earth, and I do believe in a literal reign of Christ on earth, there will be those who will have lived through the tribulation, I believe, and who will be there in their natural bodies, and who will have the opportunity of seeing all of us take whatever part we have in that time, whatever that part turns out to be, in our new body. We can talk to people, and they can see us, and they can see the living Lord, Messiah, reigning. And we're told that at the end of that time, when Satan is loosed for a little time, many will turn away. I believe it's showing us very clearly the problem is not with the impossibility mentally, intellectually, logically. It isn't that my husband who gives answers is rationalistic. That's a very different word. There is a rational understanding. We have a God who is rational. He is the one who knows all things. He has created all things. There is nothing that science discovers that God has not made for them to discover. He is the original creator, if I could put it that way. There are many copies of Rembrandt. There's only one original Rembrandt. There are many copies of what God has done in certain areas. There's only one original creation. Many who discover bits and pieces, but God made it all. To think that God does not understand all the philosophic perfection of truth is a ridiculous idea. Truth is true, and I'll end here, because I think I'm supposed to be through, and it's a good place to stop. What Fran says, I'm finishing my husband's speech, truth is true to all that exists. He often says, I believe Christianity not because it works, but because it is true, because it is truth. And it isn't that I believe that Christianity is true in the sense of that the virgin birth is true and creation is true. And he believes all these things to be true, mind you. But it isn't just a list that we would ascribe to in a creed. But what he says is truth, the truth of the Word of God, the truth of Christianity, the truth of God's existence is true to everything. It is true to all human, well, all knowledge. I won't even use the word human. All knowledge that exists that human beings don't even, haven't even understood yet. It is the truth of the universe. We don't have to be ashamed. It is not a little thing off in a box. What we have is true. And the reason that people who try to base their lives on something else get into such deep difficulties in one area and in another is because they're trying to live on the basis of what is not true. They're trying to live on the basis of being machines, trying to act like machines, trying to live on the basis of relativity where there is no base for morals, no base for law, no base for government, no base for knowing how valuable life is, no base for any actions in their lives. They're trying to live that way. And what we hear about a teenager killing another teenager right out here in a suburb a couple of days ago. I don't know the homes. I don't know the family backgrounds of these two boys, but it's what they are surrounded with. The teaching that young people are growing up are surrounded with today is that the truth doesn't even exist. That there are no absolutes, that everything is relative, that it doesn't matter what you do, you can choose your own lifestyle. It doesn't matter what lifestyle you live, just choose another one. There is no right, there is no wrong, there is no base for morals. We are the ones who have an exciting explanation that is not trivial. Far from trivial, deep, a lifetime of study would never come to the end, and we have all eternity in which to ask more questions and find out more things. but we have the essence of all we need to know, all we need to know to understand where life came from, where the creation came from, where the universe came from, what has happened to us, where the ugliness and sin and hideousness came from, where all our weaknesses and frailties and our handicaps have come from, what it's all about, and then the solution, how to live on the base of that solution now, and then the hope for the future, and a glimpse of what heaven is going to be like. A glimpse. 10,000 times 10,000 and thousands of thousands. Some from every tribe and nation and kindred and people and tongue. What the skeptics have replaced for the truth, whether in the American universities or in the Sorbonne in Paris or in with Cameron Sartre or with the philosophies in Cambridge and Oxford or in New Delhi or Indian universities or what have you, what the Buddhists have put forth and the Mohammedans and the Hindus, what has been put forth in the tribes of the islands, wherever they exist, will not have been sufficient to blind the mind of everyone. We're told that there will be some from every tribe and nation and kindred and tongue in heaven. The victory of the opening of eyes of understanding, recognizing truth, will penetrate every kind of skeptic wall, if I could put it that way. The penetration will be so that the victory of Christ will be shown to be complete as far as kinds of teaching that is blinding. There isn't going to be any totally closed in group that not one will be saved from. Now I think we are through.